The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome to the Investing in Real Estate podcast with Clayton Morris. This is the show where we focus on buy and hold real estate. Why do we do it? We do it for the purposes of creating passive income and legacy wealth for you and your family. If you're interested in finding your freedom number, come over to our website at morrisinvest.com/freedom and download your free financial freedom cheat sheet today. Hey everybody, welcome into another episode of Investing in Real Estate, the show where we focus on building passive income so you can leave a legacy for you and your family. A lot of that legacy building, as you know from past episodes and why I harp on it so much and why it's such a part of this show, is around building productive habits. It's around overcoming limiting beliefs. It's not just about, hey, I have $50,000 in the bank and I'm going to buy a $45,000 property and it's going to cash flow for me. Great. Yeah, for some of you out there, it might be that easy. And for a lot of our investors that we work with, it is that easy. But for many, many more of you, if you're like me, who've suffered from limiting beliefs, fears of money, unproductive habits, self-sabotaging language, you name it, then it's a bit of a struggle. And that's what today's episode is all about. We're very, very lucky to have Peter Bregman on the show. He's a CEO of Bregman Partners, a company that helps clients get massive traction on their most important work through what he calls the Big Arrow process. And as a coach and advisor to CEOs and their leadership teams, he's also the best-selling author of the book 18 Minutes, and his most recent book is called 4 Seconds. So we're going to dive deep into that and some of the productive habits that CEOs have that make them a success. Peter, great to have you here on the show. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It's nice to be here.
You know, you work with a lot of CEOs, of course, as a CEO trainer, and you know, a lot of our listeners are business owners, small business owners, or they're doctors, or lawyers, and now because of real estate investing, they've, you know, started their own business, right? They've incorporated, built an LLC, and they're really starting to think entrepreneurially for the first time in their lives. When you talk to these successful CEOs, where do you see the difference between those successful CEOs and maybe the newbie CEO who's sort of struggling and doesn't even see themselves as the same caliber as the people that you coach?
You know, it's interesting. Even the way you phrase the question is interesting. I don't know that I see a difference between newbie versus experienced, but I definitely see a difference between average and excellent. So I see some new CEOs that come into their roles and they're actually really tremendously effective. And it does have to do with the kinds of behaviors and focus that they bring to the position. And I actually think it's very related to investing. I think that, you know, the most effective CEOs have a bias towards action and a clear sense of the outcome that they're going for and how they have to work through people in order to get there. Most CEOs don't actually do anything, right? You know, in terms of the technical aspects of the organizations that they're running, but everything has to be done through the people around them. And, you know, that's not exactly the same in terms of real estate investing. And I'm a real estate investor myself. But the idea that you have to be really clear about the outcome you want, and then you have to be thoughtful about the kinds of actions that you take that will get you there. And you have to be biased towards actions. The CEOs who fail are the ones who sit around and think a lot, but don't actually move forward on anything. And it's the same thing with real estate investing. I mean, if you're going to, you know, analyze 100 different properties and not actually make a move on any of them, Well, on the one hand, if they're all overvalued, you know, and the numbers don't work, that's pretty smart. But if you're, you know, really risk averse and choosing not to, you know, for fear of a potential loss, choosing not to take any action, you're going to have a hard time as a real estate investor.
Right. The risk averse part, you've got to, you know, if you're going to take action and people think, you know, risk averse is what keeps people from taking action. Fact of the matter is, when you're a real estate investor, yes, it can be risky if you don't know what you're doing, but for the most part, it's even less risky than a lot of things out there. But people wrap their brain around the unknown and they tie risk to it. Even it just comes down to a lack of education. It comes down to a lack of understanding.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's, you know, risk is can be looked at in one of two ways. It could be kind of intellectual and rational, or it could be emotional.
Right.
And there's, you know, you could run the numbers and recognize, you know, the kind of actual risk that you're taking and assign numbers to it very quantitatively. And you can think, wow, this is a lot of money. And what happens if I lost it? You know, and that feeling, which is very real too. And I think that's the challenge. And, you know, there's a number of ways out of that challenge. But in my view, the most useful way out of it is to have a very clear process that you trust 100% and that you kind of follow. So, you know, it's the most challenging that people find, the biggest challenges that people have when they're investing money is emotional responses. The market goes down, they sell everything, it goes back up, that's when they buy. And that's, you know, a pretty good recipe for losing all of your money slowly. And, or maybe not so slowly, but if you have a real process and you say, what's the valuation of this particular property and, you know, what kind of money will, I mean, I have a process, for example, and I might be speaking out of bounds here because, you know, I'm really focused on leadership and CEOs and, you know, the show is about real estate investing. And I'll tell you that, you know, as a very, very basic principle, the most simple way I evaluate a property is what kind of return can this property get, whether it's Bingo. Residential or commercial. And you know, when you look at the bubbles and you look and say, hey, what kind of return can this make? People are banking on the fact that the property will continue to rise in value. That's a risk, you know, and it's a risk if it's out of the money and ultimately, you know, you're going to invest in a property and make 1 or 2%. On that property, but you're assuming that the prices will rise and you'll be able to sell it again in 5 years, you know, at a much higher rate so that, you know, you make your money back. To me, I mean, you and I haven't talked real estate and you might have a very different sense of tolerance, but for me, that's not a bet I would want to make. But if I'm, you know, getting a return of, you know, 8 or 10 or 12%, you know, year over year, then I'm willing to take that risk because even if the property doesn't rise in value, I'll be okay.
Well, I mean, that's the key of what everything we talk about here is ROI. I mean, we don't, you know, I won't buy a property unless we can get between a net 10 and 12% ROI when we're done with it. You know, gross is over, you know, usually like 20%. So that's my tolerance for what properties that we buy and renovate and place a tenant in. So you're speaking my language, right? It's like, I know what my numbers are. I know what my goals are. And I have my, you know, and I have my strategy for every property that we buy. But a lot of people, you know, get overwhelmed, they get stressed. And one of the things you talk about in your book, 4 Seconds, this idea that we have this, we're just going to work harder and longer hours. We're going to put in more time. We're just going to suffer through it. I speak to so many investors, Peter, who, you know, are driving 2 hours to and from work. They don't get to see their kids. And they think that the way out of it is to do more of that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you make this great point, right? Which is that you have your process and then it gets emotional. And I think here's the key, here's the recipe. Develop a process you trust when you are unemotional about it. Be thoughtful, think about your numbers, think about how you want to analyze a property, and then lock yourselves in. I was talking to a friend of mine about losing weight. And I was saying, you know, sort of, we were talking about various ways of losing weight. And I said, you know, there's all sorts of different ways that, you know, there's a million books out there about losing weight. But the ones that I think are most useful are the ones that take decision-making off the table. So you just follow process. Here's the example. I'm Jewish and I'm kosher. And kosher in a way where I don't eat shrimp or I don't eat pork. And I go to a dinner. I was at a dinner two nights ago where there's a huge place, plate of sort of shellfish in front of me. It was, like one of those things they bring to the table and it's on ice and there's shrimp and lobsters and oysters and everything. And it was not difficult for me to make a decision not to eat any of it because it is such a clear, bright line that I don't eat any of that stuff. I didn't have to think about it. I didn't struggle about it. I didn't go back and forth. Wow, it might be tasty. It's just off the table. And what I was saying to this person is if you want to lose weight, do the same thing with sugar, right? Just take it off the table. Don't sit there trying to decide at the heat of the moment when they bring you the dessert menu, do I eat sugar or not this time? If you've decided you're not going to eat sugar and you don't eat sugar, you're 80% of the way there. Probably do the same thing with flour.
Right.
Now, from a real estate investing perspective or from a management perspective or from a leadership perspective, any of this, it's like decide not when you're reading the dessert menu, not when you're in the heat of the moment, not when someone's yelling at you or, you know, the market's starting to change. That's not when you decide. You decide at a moment when you're calm and you're thoughtful and you're rational and you decide, what are the rules of this game? What are the rules of the game of communication for leadership, you know, that I talk a lot about? Or from a real estate investment, what's the rules of the game? What are the numbers? What am I going to do when the market does this or that? And you make those decisions when you're mellow and thoughtful and unstressed, and then you're done. And you let your emotions go up and down, enjoy them, let it stress you out, have fun, look as the property goes up, as the property goes down. None of that should allow you to deviate from your plan. And that's true for leadership. It's true for investing. It's true for just about anything.
So not to be swayed. Well, people have a tendency to be swayed by shiny object syndrome, or when one little thing goes bad can totally take them off course. You mentioned at the outset the difference between average CEOs and excellent CEOs. What would you say is the difference between an average CEO or an average investor and an excellent CEO?
I would say they are very adept at distinguishing signal from noise. There's a tremendous amount of noise out there, and it's true for CEOs, it's true for investors. You know, you could every day read 20 articles that will tell you all sorts of different things and signal all sorts of projections, and none of them, you know, for the most part, in my view, really know what they're talking about,
right?
Because it could go any way. So like some of them will be right in the end, but you have no idea which ones. And that's all noise. And so figure out what your signal is. What is the thing that you want everyone to pay attention to? When I do the big arrow process you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, is all about that organizationally. It's looking at an organization and saying, what is the most important thing to achieve over the next 12 months? That's your signal. How are we going to, what is the behaviors that we need to demonstrate that will help us to achieve that? Those are your signals. Everything else is noise. And so figure out from an investment perspective, what is the signal? What is the noise? And block the noise out. Recognize when you see something is noise and let it go.
Today's episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter.com. Are you hiring right now? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Well, with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job. It's better than anyone else. You know, they're going to find the right person for this particular job. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. So it kind of goes out and searches for them. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within one day. This has been our experience because as our company expands, we need to hire. And we need to hire the right people for the right job. So what's great about this is there's no juggling of emails or calls into your office. You simply screen And you can rate the individual as well. And then you manage the candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right. You can do it for free. They're not going to charge you anything if you go to ZipRecruiter.com/investing. So go to ZipRecruiter.com/investing. One more time. Try it for free today. Again, you don't have to pay anything to post a job. That's amazing. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/investing and check them out today. Thanks, ZipRecruiter. I want to talk about your book, 4 Seconds, and you talk about the keys to success in this idea of the fast-moving world, pausing for as few as 4 seconds, the length of a deep breath. Why that, and how did you come up with that?
Well, actually, you really only need 1 to 2 seconds, but I felt being very generous, I would give people twice the amount of time that you actually need. When you react to something, if someone yells at me and I yell back, right? Just think about that scenario. Someone yells at me and my adrenaline flows and I've got a hit to my amygdala. The amygdala is the part of your brain that is the emotional center of your brain. It's kind of reptilian in nature. It's, you know, freeze or fight or, you know, run. And it's that's the part of your brain where you react out of and usually regret it afterwards. What you need to do when something happens that you would react to is that you have to give enough time for the stimulus to go literally from your brain, from the amygdala to the neocortex. The neocortex is the front of the brain. It developed later evolutionarily, and it is the part of your brain that is thoughtful and rational and logical and allows you to think. And breathing actually helps slow down your reaction and give time for the stimulus to go from your amygdala to your neocortex. It actually mellows out the nervous system also. So 4 seconds is all the time that you need to replace a counterproductive habit with one that works, because it's the amount of time you need to shortcut, to stop, to short circuit the reactive amygdala response that you would have and slow yourself down enough to take a thoughtful, rational response to a situation instead of reaction to a situation. And so the book, 4 Seconds, is all about developing that capability to sort of have a moment of awareness to realize you're about to do something that's probably not in your best interest, to have an ability to resist the urge to follow through on what you would have done, and finally to replace the ineffective reaction with a strategic and intentional response. And that's the game. And that's what 4 Seconds is all about.
I love that you call it a game, because my wife and I have been deep diving watching The Matrix lately again. You know, it's a good movie to watch every few years. And the idea of having this emotional intelligence, I think at the end of it, it ultimately is a movie about emotional intelligence. Being plugged into this matrix of reaction, right? Living in a state of constant reaction in our world, rather than treating it like a game where we can take a deep breath and realize that every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So if my reaction to that person cutting me off in traffic is to also elevate to that level of, you know, rudeness, then I'm adding to a greater level of like collective unconsciousness, right? Or if I take a deep breath, I could have a different reaction, which is to say maybe some empathy and to say, that person's probably having a bad day, you know, and totally redirect it in an opposite way.
I love, Clayton, that you pulled that out of what I said and the focus of the game, because I think it highlights something really important, which is we take ourselves and other people way too seriously. And I think if you know, like we intensify our reaction when we take everything seriously, when we let things go a little bit more loosely, then we can allow people to be wrong. We can allow people to do stuff that annoys us and not get so annoyed and therefore preserve the relationship or be more effective. You know, that's true in negotiation. If you're, you know, either a leader or a real estate investor, right, you're having to negotiate. And if you get so caught up and wrapped up in the negotiation, you'll probably have a a much harder time. And it's, you know, I'm not a golfer, although I'm beginning to think I should be. And I was having a conversation with a well-known leader who's loves golf and relaxes with golf. And this is a sort of big senior level political leader. And he was saying to me, what he loves about golf is that the more tense you get, the worse you are at it. And the more stressed out, the worse you are. And that in order to be really effective at golf, you have to really be relaxed and loose, which the more stressed you are is harder to do. So you have to learn how to, in stressful moments, totally relax in order to be good at the game. And that was the first time I've heard the game described in a way that says, like, wow, that's a life skill. And that would be really useful to learn.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it. Because when I play golf, I get super stressed. I want to smack the club against a tree. So, right. Yeah, I haven't played
which
in a
works
few.
Which works for the wrestling league, but not so much for golf, as I understand it.
Yeah, well, I love that idea. And we'll kind of get you out of here on this. And we know you're up against a hard break, as am I today. I could talk about this all day. These counterproductive habits, if you had to pick three of the most counterproductive habits that you see people making, what would you say those are?
I would say that the first is they think about themselves more than they think about the people around them. And that's true even in, you know, someone on the other side of the table around a negotiation, that they're in their own, you know, they're all about what they want and what they need, and not so thoughtful about what the other person needs. And I would say that even, you know, in a hard negotiation, to be in service of the person across the table from you is a very effective methodology. That's one. Second is, you know, I see us constantly doing things that are counter to what we most want. And, the example I'll give you is, you know, I see somebody work out really hard at the gym and then go downstairs and go out to the donut shop, you know, or the ice cream shop and, you know, buy a big thing that they're eating. And they wonder why their body hasn't changed if they're trying to change. And, you know, I use these kinds of examples simply. I realize I've used two examples about weight just in this short time, but because they're so instructive, because they... they're so clearly measurable, right? If people work out really hard, their bodies should change. If their body's not changing and they're still working out really hard, they're probably doing something that's against their self-interest, that's blocking all of that effort that they're putting into it. And I think we do that all the time. And the third is, I think, we don't often enough ask the question, and feel like we're in control of the answer, am I happy? I think we kind of ask that question a lot, but we put the answer on external circumstances instead of really our own responsibility. And I think if you go into every day saying, you know, what can I, you know, am I doing my best to be happy? That changes how we approach things.
What, I'll ask you this question, give you a few seconds to think about it. What does happiness mean to you, if you had to define it? I'll tell you what it means to me. And I've struggled with this over the years to kind of define this. For a lot of, you know, I started out with a lot of fears around money and negativity around that. So a lot of my audience knows that too well. But, you know, fears of success, all of those things, those nagging anxieties and the little voices in my head. So for me, happiness is when I can sit down quietly, whether it's just with my 9-month-old little girl or my other kids, and be purely present and sort of, and you get this like feeling, even if it's in a meditation or where you can just sit quietly, taking a deep breath as you talk about in the book, and just being present where this sort of feeling, it's almost like a tingly feeling, sort of washes over you in a way where you just feel pure joy. Like that to me is what happiness looks like to me. And it, you know, comes and goes. It doesn't happen all the time, but I know when it comes and it feels amazing. And it just, it's like pure elation. You know, you get a smile, you just feel warm and nothing can bring you down. And then the other times, of course, you can feel down in the dumps and all these little things are nagging at you and picking at you. And it's really hard to get back to that place of happiness. What about you? How would you define happiness?
You know, I think I might define it in the same way. The way I would, you know, the way I want to answer the question is how I bring about happiness.
Yeah,
right?
That's better.
So and the way I bring about happiness, and actually as I'm thinking about it, I'm really glad that you asked me the question because I had to think about it. Like what do I actually do to bring about happiness? And the answer surprised me a little bit, although it probably shouldn't, but it reminds me what I need to do more of in my life, which is when I am in service to other people, like when I am doing things that that make other people's lives better, it really makes me happy. And I think it's easy, you know, you sort of talked about, you know, growing up and fear of losing money or not having enough money. And I think, you know, we all have that to various degrees, but I grew up in a way where I didn't have to worry about money, but I somehow got the message that you always have to sort of worry about money. And I have that message. And I think that can get us to become self-involved in a way that brings us away from happiness. And I think the idea of really being in service brings me at least to happiness.
Oh, that's a great point. My wife likes to say that it's healing people. And whether it's, you know, working with an investor on the phone and we solve a problem and whatever, they've gotten their next property or they now they're seeing their first rent check or whatever it happens to be, like those moments where we're able to solve a problem and sort of, as my wife says, heal someone, it's like I get off the phone and I have a big smile on my face, you know, and it's not to like pat, you know, that's not about patting yourself on the back, but it's just like, oh, I helped this person. And maybe I, you know, gave of myself in that time or in whatever way it was, you know, a young college student just getting started investing, doesn't know where to turn. They're hearing all these nagging voices from people in their school. And it's like, if I can just spend a few minutes kind of pointing that person in the right direction, maybe it might save them 10 years of anguish being pointed in the wrong direction. And that's a great feeling to have. So yeah, I love that. Go out there and try to be of service to other people is a great way to bring happiness. Well, it's been so great having you here on the show, Peter. Where can people connect with you? Of course, we're going to have links to your book and everything you do in our show notes page, but how can people connect with you?
If you go to peterbregman.com, that's the best way. And there's lots of ways to contact me through there, but PETERBREGMAN.com.
Perfect. Perfect. My guest has been Peter Bregman, author of the brand new book, 4 Seconds, All the Time You Need to Replace Counterproductive Habits with the Ones That Really Work. Go check out his book. That'll be linked up on our page. Thank you so much, Peter. It's been a real pleasure having you here on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been my pleasure as well, Clayton.
And thanks to all of you for subscribing to the podcast and pushing us over the 4 million download mark. We really appreciate it. Thanks to all of your kind feedback. We publish this show every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We'll be back next week on Monday with another episode of Investing in Real Estate. Until then, go out there, take action. And by the way, take 4 seconds, take a deep breath, and replace some of those counterproductive habits with ones that will change your life. We'll talk with you next time, everyone. Much love to you all.